Our next reader is Heather Fries. Here's her haiku. Writing is so hard, so I'm changing my major to pro beachcombing. Heather.
Okay, I'm just going to read a little bit from a brand new story that hasn't even been workshopped yet, so if you don't like it, don't blame my classmates. This is Kid Dynamite. Mike Tyson was the first man to disappoint me. I was on vacation in Ohio when I met him. I know, right? Who vacations in Ohio? But when you grow up in the coastal tourist mecca that is the Outer Banks of North Carolina, Ohio seems just fine as a getaway destination. I still think about those green, green hills, about how every day seemed green and blue and gold, but maybe that's just how every day feels when you're a kid. My Ohio friend, Charlotte, lived in the kind of house you'd expect my Ohio friend, Charlotte, to live in once you saw her perfect face and her perfect family. White, two-storied, little fancy dollops of woodworking all around the porch and everywhere. And one of her neighbors in this pretty, perfect, green and blue and gold Ohio town happened to be the boxing promoter Don King. His hair really is that crazy on a daily basis. Every day, Charlotte and I would gather up Charlotte's friends, Sarah L. and Sarah M., and we'd go play freeze tag around the statues on Don King's front lawn. Mike Tyson and the other boxers, I know there were others, but I don't remember their names, trained in these tent things in the backyard, punching and jabbing and floating and singing like birds or bees or whatever. We made them stop to watch us do cartwheels. My cartwheels sucked. I never took gymnastics. Charlotte's, of course, as to be expected, were perfect, and she always remembered to point her toes. But the point is, Mike Tyson never failed to stop jib-jabbing to watch me, and so I thought he was a pretty nice guy. Whenever he came on TV, I'd point and tell people that I knew him and that we were pretty much best friends. I was slightly prone to exaggeration when I was younger. In the sixth grade, I told Jessica Jones that I had a bionic toe. She believed me for a whole year. Okay, so maybe this was less of an exaggeration and more of an outright lie, but you get the picture. Mike Tyson called me on the phone with his little girl voice and wished me happy birthday. Mike Tyson baked me a batch of fudge brownies with swirls of caramel. Mike Tyson won me a goldfish at the county fair. And then Mike Tyson raped that girl, and I stopped saying that he was my best friend, but kids don't let you forget, and so then I was friends with a rapist. This did not help my social standing. And then he went and bit that guy's ear off. The ear biting sticks out in my mind as much or more than the rape. I just keep seeing the blood. After that, I never mentioned Mike Tyson to my friends again, but I somehow felt that his life stained mine. My husband is not the second man to disappoint me, not the third or the fourth, so by the time his disappointments start to really roll in, you'd think I'd be braced for them. You'd think his metaphorical ear-biting would not come as a complete and total shock. You'd think I'd be prepared for it when Stephen says, "Evie, we need to sell the house," but I'm not. "What do you mean, sell the house?" I say. It's morning, and the light slices down through my window into my crazy, cozy little kitchen where I spend so much time boiling and baking and basting as a way to breathe. Stephen leans against the counter like he hasn't a care in the world. Casual. He eats a bagel. He's wearing khaki pants, and I wonder if he's going into work in his father's store today. I was talking to Royce Burris at your office when I picked you up the other day, and he said we could get a good sum for the property. I squeeze at a dish rag and wipe at the kitchen table, looking down and hoping that Stephen doesn't see my face color at Royce's name. I have kind of a crush on Royce. I take a second and listen to the loud commercial blasting from the living room where my son, Austin, is watching TV. But where would we live? I'm not saying it's a perfect plan, Stephen says. He crosses the kitchen and sits down in front of me at the table. But we could stay with your folks or mine until the cash clears and then build somewhere, maybe up in Buxton. I sit down. This sounds like an okay plan. This sounds thought out and maybe even mature, but I know that Stephen's teeth are awfully close to my ear. Maybe if you got an actual job, then we wouldn't be so strapped for cash that we have to sell our home, I say. I lean forward on the table a little bit, and my arms get sticky with damp from the dish rag. Stephen's mouth tightens. It's an old argument, and it goes like this. I say, "Get a job." He says, "I'm staying at home with Austin." I say, "You're never home with him, and I know this because I drop him off at my parents' every day before I go to work so I can keep his medical insurance while you fuck around on your jet ski." He says, "I'm above working any jobs on this island." He doesn't say it in exactly those words, but that's what he means, and that's what he honestly, truly believes. But it's not below me to peddle beach houses to tourists every day because I'm just that low. He believes this, too. I know it. Stephen crosses his arms, and the sunlight glints off his watch. "I have a job," he says. "Part-time stock boy for your father doesn't count," I say. He works in the back where no one can see him and does it out of obligation to his father who basically bought our house for us. Stephen shakes his head. "God damn it, Evie," he says. "Austin can hear you," I say. "You can't hear a fucking thing over that goddamn TV." Stephen lowers his voice all the same. "I don't know why you let him watch it so much." I stand up and head for the living room. "You're the stay-at-home father. Why don't you monitor him?" across the room to where Austin sits on his knees, and trance by Go Diego Go. My son is small and dark-haired, and I'm always kind of thankful that he looks like me. Come on, kid, I say, reaching down to pull him up from under his armpits. Time to go to Grandma's. Austin has the charming habit of kicking the passenger seat on our daily rides up the island. I guess if I was strapped down in a car seat, I'd kick too, but it doesn't ease my annoyance. And I am strapped down, come to think of it, with my own seatbelt. How about you cut that out, buddy, I say. I look in the rearview mirror, but Austin is looking away. I want to hear the Hollaback song, he says, and I die a little bit inside. Every day, he wants to hear Hollaback Girl. This was cute at first when he sang, I ain't no Harlem Black Girl, and I had to correct him so people wouldn't think he was a racist. But he wants it every day. Every day we drive up the same road and listen to the same songs, and I think of my friend Charlotte saying that you can't get lost on an island because pretty soon you'll drive off the end, and right now I kind of want to drive off the end. But I pop in the cassette I recorded from my dad's old stereo instead and think about how Stephen goes jogging every morning with his iPod. And then I make myself think about how I want Austin to grow up with a family, with a mom and a dad in a little white house. A little white house that Stephen wants to sell. The morning is bright and sunny for February, the light dancing and sparkles off the water of the Pamlico Sound as Highway 12 passes close to the water. Austin kicks the seat in time to the music. I fumble for my sunglasses and sing along with Gwen Stefani.